Welcome, everyone, to this WebSphere Support Technical Exchange session. Today's topic is Web Container Part 1, Concepts and Administration. This session is the first of two-part Web Container Education Series. This session is geared towards Web Container Concepts and Administration, including the purpose and use of common properties. On Thursday, September 11th, Web Container Part 2 covers common issues and step-by-step debugging strategies. The presenters today are Ashish Gajsera, Fu Din, Gabriel Marquez, and Tan Jian. Gabriel joined IBM in 2007, working the system verification test team for the WebSphere Application Server 6.1 EJB feature pack release. In 2011, he was able to apply and extend his experience with WebSphere testing by joining the WebSphere Level 2 support community in his current role of Client Technical Resolution Specialist. He serves as technical software support to clients globally, specializing in WebSphere web application configuration and problem resolution. Tom has been working in WebSphere Application Server Level 2 support for 8 years. She supports many WebSphere runtime components such as Web Container, JSP, JSF, Class Loader, Web Service, etc. She specializes in WebSphere Class Loader and Web Container. Ashish works in WebSphere Application Server Technical Support Organization for 11 years. He is team lead, technical lead, and subject matter expert of many components of WebSphere Application Server products. In this capacity, he has worked very closely with many customers and resolved complex critical issues and enabled them to succeed using IBM solutions. Along these years, he has also contributed towards improving product quality, technical skill improvements, reducing hours per problems, and serviceability and usability improvements. Fu has been working on the WebSphere Container Component Level 3 support since 2007. In his role, he has helped customers resolve application issues during server migration. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Gabriel.
Thank you, Kathy. Today's agenda, let's turn over to page 2, slide 2, and we'll see today's agenda. We're going to look at the 50,000-foot view of the Java servlet specification, kind of focusing in on a few key areas. The next point will be some of the web container settings that are available, focusing on the most popular. The same is true with the web container attributes, some of the most popular and common attributes. We'll also see a sample of how to configure them in the IBM-web-ext.xmi file and the IBM-web-ext.xml file. We'll also be doing the same with the web container custom properties, focusing on the most commonly used properties, and see a sample of how to configure them via the administrative console. For virtual host configuration, we'll look at what a virtual host is and how to map the web application to that virtual host. Finally, we'll wrap this up by looking at the Java EE application structure. So what does that file system look like? Where are XML files located? And what to look for within those common XML files? So let's get right into the presentation here. Let's go to slide number 3. And this is the areas where we'll be looking at, we'll be focusing on the servlet. Within the Java servlet specification, we'll start with the servlet and then go into the web container, servlet request and response objects, some filtering and some security options that are available. So let's start with the servlet. The servlet is a Java class file that implements the javax.servlet. It's used for dynamic web content generation and conforms to the Java servlet API. This uses a request and response paradigm, so every request that's generated and received, a response is generated and returned. And this is typically launched from a web page. The servlet is executed outside of the browser, inside the JVM, or the Java Virtual Machine. In this case, this would be the web container for the WebSphere application server. Now, the servlet can perform many different tasks. The three that we're going to focus on are a read, a send, and a generate results. So when we say read, we mean that it can actually read explicit data sent by the browser. So think of a form page on a web application. A user types in their name, address, city, state, zip, some other information. All of that gets sent to the servlet. It can read that. It can also read implicit HTTP request data, such as cookies or metadata types. When we talk about generating results, this means that the servlet itself can take some of those input parameters, do whatever magic it needs to do, and generate the response. This may involve either talking to a database or executing some type of web service or even going through and actually computing a response directly. The most common example would be when information from a database needs to be retrieved. Your real data is in a relational database, but you don't want that web browser actually interfacing directly with the database. So you want it packaged up in a nice, neat little bow. You want it filtered for any security concerns. And so you use this servlet to do that retrieval, to do all the packaging, to do all the filtering. And so the end user, all they see is a nice, neat little display. Now, when we talk about send, this can send, respond with static files. Say you have a PDF or a static file that you want rendered. The servlet can handle that. And it can send implicit HTTP response data, such as either the document itself or some other type of response. With that, let's go and look at slide number 5. Like every good Java object, there is a life cycle to these objects. Typically, it's a creation, execution, and a destruction. In the object-oriented paradigm, we talk about instantiation or initialization. That is that creation process. The service is where that servlet gets executed, or it does whatever it needs to do to whatever it was built to do. And the destruction method is where, you know, everything is kind of closed up, all the loose ends are tied off. Whatever is executing gets finished executing, and no more requests are received for that servlet. In this case, the container will load and instantiate the servlet, and this may be with or without parameters from the outside. And this will read persistent configuration data. It will initialize any type of costly resources. So a database connection, while it is a little expensive, there is some overhead with that, so that will get created on initialization, and perform any other one-time activities. When a servlet is destroyed, it will release any of its resources, save any persistent data that needs to be saved, and anything that's executing will be allowed to complete, but it will not receive any more requests. If that same servlet is needed, it can always be reinstantiated again. We can always recreate it. What we can't do is go back and use a servlet that's already been destroyed. And once it's destroyed, it goes through the garbage collection process for the JVM. So looking at slide 5, we're going to look at a typical invocation of a servlet. So let's say an end user visits a URL. They're going to type the URL in a browser. That browser generates an HTTP request for this URL, and that request is sent to the appropriate server. Typically, this is a web server, that sits in the middle, and that web server is going to forward that request to the servlet container. The container will then map that request to the specific servlet that's being requested. The servlet is dynamically retrieved, and we're assuming this is the first time the servlet has been called. So it's dynamically retrieved, loaded into the web container, and the init or the initialization method is invoked on that servlet. All that good pre-processing work is done. The servlet object exists. Now it is possible to pass the initialization parameters to the servlet so that it can configure itself. Once that's done, the service method of the servlet is called. Now, this is where all the good action happens. This is where all the connections are made, and the servlet does what it was created to do. It processes the HTTP request. It reads any data that's needed to be read. It formulates the response, and it returns a response. Now, the servlet will remain in the container's address space, and it will be available for any other requests for that specific servlet. And the reason we do that is for performance reasons. It'll stay active. Now, it will stay active until the destroy method is called. And either once the destroy method is called, all the resources are going to be relinquished. Anything that's already executing will continue to execute until completion. But that servlet is considered dead as far as the web container is concerned. And any memory that's allocated for that object will be marked for garbage collection once everything's finished closing out. Let's go over to the next slide, slide number 7. And we're going to look at this and kind of focus in on the WebSphere side. So the web container, and you'll see that web container kind of in the middle, it's a little shaded there. It contains and manages servlets throughout their life cycle, and it can handle the HTTP or HTTPS protocols for requests and responses. On rare occasions, it can be configured to modify either a request or response, or it may respond to a request without actually having to deliver it to the end servlet. It will enforce any type of security restrictions that are created or used for the application, and it will process servlets, JSP files, and other types of server-side includes, and that includes is something specific to servlets. It will use what is at its disposal, whether that's Dynacache or security, basically anything it needs. And if you look at the image, you can see how it can go out to either Java clients, application data. We can go down to a database. Whatever is needed, that web container makes sure that the servlet has everything it needs to do what it was created to do. Well, let's go on to slide number 8, and let's kind of look at what that URL looks like and how it's mapped in. At the top, you see the request URI is comprised of 4 main components. The context path or the context root, that's the path prefix that is associated with the servlet context that this servlet is a part of. The servlet path is the mapped servlet location in the web XML. And the path section that directly corresponds to the mapping which activated this request. The path info is basically the path that is not part of the context path or the servlet path, and the query string is going to be any type of parameters or initialization parameters that are needed. If we look at the example down below, you kind of see where things are broken up, where the context path is, that context root, the servlet path, where that servlet exists in the web.xml, and the path info. Now, the path info is many times it's null. It's an optional piece of the request URI. So let's go to slide number 9, and we're going to look at the request object. Like all good Java objects, there is a request lifecycle, so creation, instantiation, and destruction. In this case, what's presented here at the bottom Now, each request object is valid only within the scope of a servlet's service method or when within the scope of a filter's do filter method. And we'll talk about filters in a couple slides down the road. Containers commonly recycle request objects in order to avoid the performance overhead of request object creation. And a developer must be aware that maintaining any type of reference to a request object outside of this is really frowned upon. And what we have in the web container excerpt here is where that was actually occurring. If you notice, when a request is handled, we reuse the request object. In this case, at the top, it shows request object at 890, and it's got that whole serial name. That's the ID for the request object. Later on, another one is used. You notice it says servlet request at AB65 and so on. And so what's happened is this AB65 has actually been destroyed at an earlier point in time, but for some reason it was stored and tried to be used again. Web container didn't have what it needed for that object to be used, so the null pointer exception was thrown. Let's go to slide number 9. And we're going to look at the servlet response object. Now, this object basically encapsulates all the information that is going to go back or going to be the response to whatever was requested. It follows the HTTP protocol, and we'll have a header, a message body, and a status code. And like all good Java objects, it does have a life cycle. Each response object is valid only within the scope of the servlet's service method or within the scope of the filter's do filter method. And it is not unusual for the web container to recycle these responses, again, for performance reasons. Let's go to slide number 10. Now, we talked about destroy method, and when destruction is called, everything needs to be cleaned up. So the container must immediately flush all remaining content in the response buffer to the client. All of that gets pushed, all that information gets pushed out to the client. And what we can look at to know for sure that this servlet is ready for closure is we're going to look at the termination of the service method of the servlet. We're going to make sure that service method has been executed completely. The amount of content specified in the set content length method has actually been satisfied. So if we say we're going to send 4,095 bytes, we've actually sent 4,095 bytes. The send error method is called, or some type of send redirect method is called. Again, all the details of this are available in the Java servlet specification. So we've been talking a little bit about filters. We've mentioned them a few times. Let's go to slide 11 and take a more in-depth look at that. Now, a filter is a reusable piece of code that can transform the content of an HTTP request, a response, or any type of header information. It can modify or adapt the request for a resource or modify or adapt the response from a resource. It can act on dynamic or static content. And let's go to the next slide, slide number 12. And these filters can actually be stacked or chained, what we call a filter chain. This is a sequence of filters with each filter doing some processing and then passing it on to the next filter in that sequence. And each object has a chain member to point to the next filter in the sequence. So if you start at the top, say that's filter A, the next one's filter B, the next one's filter C, as a request comes in, filter A will pick up the request, do whatever it does, filter B is going to be in there, filter C is going to be in there. We're going to go down to the endpoint and finally do package all the response that we need to respond, send that response out, and we're going to pop stuff off the stack. Filter C, filter B, filter A get executed. So at all points, these filters are able to touch, handle, or modify, change, whatever they're designed to do, they can do at this point. Let's go to slide 13. We're going to look at security now. So when we say declarative security, we refer to the means of expressing an application security structure. And this includes roles, access control, authentication requirements. And this is done in a form external to the application. So the deployment descriptor is a primary vehicle for declarative security in the web application. Now, the deployer will map the application's logical security requirements to a representation of the security policy that is specific to that runtime environment. At runtime, the servlet container uses the security policy representation to enforce authentication and authorization. You can think of this as authentication gets you in the building, authorization gets you in the specific room that you need access to. Let's take a little look at that in slide number 14 when we look at security roles. Now, roles, we define roles as a logical grouping of users defined by the application developer or assembler. So this is something specific to the application that the developer has decided. When an application is deployed, roles are mapped by a deployer to principles or groups in the runtime environment. And a servlet container will enforce declarative or programmatic security for those roles, whatever is defined by the application. In the example, it's from a web XML, and that can show the security role reference foo to the security role with the role name manager in the syntax. So you can see how that's done. The most common example of this is with our WebSphere application administrative console. Within that administrative console, we can define a moderator role. There's a monitor role and a configurator role and a administrator role. A monitor, anyone that's associated with that monitor can only view what content is there. It can view the status of the servers. They can't change anything. The administrator can change pretty much anything except security configuration. So anything that falls under that security umbrella, they'll be denied access to. Now, administrator security role is created so that that person can manage all the security stuff. But all of that has to be designed by the developer. At this point, let's go to slide number 15. And we'll be turning our attention over to Than Giang as she continues this presentation.
Thank you, Gabriel. So my name is Than Giang, and I will be presenting the web container configuration and administration. So let's go to the slide 16, please. So first, we will look at the web container setting from the Advent console. You can find this panel under the application server name, web container. The property that we look at is the default virtual host. By default, this virtual host is set to the default host. So if you want your app to use different virtual hosts, you can define it under different panel under like environment virtual host. After you define that virtual host, then you can go back to this panel and click on the drop-down list there to select your new virtual host. The next property is enable servlet and command caching. This setting is handled by Dynacache components, so we will not be discussed in this presentation. The one below is disable servlet request and response pooling. So by default, this option is disabled. When you enable this option, the new request, servlet request, and service response objects are created for each request. This creates additional overhead as a result of increase in request and response object creation. So the subsequent garbage collection of these discard objects can cause a performance impact. But this provides protection from unforeseen pulling bugs. The next property is asynchronous servlet properties. So starting in WebSphere version 8.0, we add this feature, this setting because we start to support the server 3.0. So you will not see this part of the configuration in Grassfield version 7.0 and older. So the asynchronous server features enable you to process the incoming request and respond without being bound to the original thread that initiated the request. In another word, like, you want the request to be processed and a response generated asynchronously, which can be improved the server response time. So this is useful in a long wait situation, like waiting for a database connection. So the next property is on the top right-hand corner under additional property, asynchronous request dispatching, so which is also called ARD. ARD, you know, we provide this feature in Grassfield 7.0 before Server 3.0. So it serves similar functionality as a single server feature. So both features, you know, a single server feature and ARD are using different API, different implementations, but it achieves the same goal. So ARD is an IBM implementation. While the asynchronous server is coming with the server 3.0. So under the additional property, the is the custom property. So when you want to configure the web container custom property, then click on this link and that will navigate to you to the panel that I have the picture show on the bottom right-hand corner there. The other two property is a web container transport chains. This one mostly using by the channel framework. And the last one is the session management. And this is using by the XP session manager. So those are part of the two different components and we will not discuss in this presentation. So please go to slide 17. So now let's look at some of the most popular web container attributes. You know, the web container attributes are configured at the application level, and you configure that in the IBM Web Extension XMI or XML file, and they are only used by that specific application. So I mentioned the XMI and XML file. The reason is that, you know, if the application using the older version of the Java EE, it will have the IBM Web Extension XMI file. But for any application that use the Java EE 5 and later, the file extension for this file is an XML. So that's the difference there. But, you know, we still can configure the same attribute in both these files. The first attribute that we look at is the file serving enable. By default, it's set to true, which means that the application is served the static file. So if you want the web server to serve the static file instead, then you can change this the value for this attribute to false. The next attribute is directory browsing enable. In the older version of Grassfield, the default value for this attribute was true, but due to the security exposure, we changed the value, the default value to false. When you enable this attribute, the application server will allow to display the content of the web module files. But that does not include the WebBINF folder. Okay, please go to slide 18. So, servlet by class name enable. By default, it's set to false. If you set it to true, then it allows the servlet to be served through a URI, which introduces a security exposure. So if you still want to continue to the servlet by its class name, then set the web container custom property com IBM WS web container. This allow serve servlet by class name to false, and then set the serve servlet by class name enable to true, in the IBM Web Extension XML file. I have also included a tech note link here for the security exposure, so you can take a look at that for more detail. That's where we introduce this property. Go to slide 19, please. Standard document root. If you have a resource outside of the WAR module and are used by the application, you can configure the extended document root to specify the directory path to the resource. So this is similar to the share library concept, so where you can put the commons file for the application to use. So you can use the extended document root as part of the file serving attribute, where you can specify the directory path to the static file. Or you can use the extended document root as part of the JSP attribute to specify a directory path to the JSP file. Okay, the last popular web container attribute is reloading enable. By default, it's set to true, so which means when you update the application file, such as like server or JSP, WebSphere will automatically start and restart the application to pick up the update files. So if you enable this attribute, you will have to manually restart the application to pick up any update files that you make change in your application. Below there is a sample, is an example of the IBM Web Extension file where you can define where you can find the configuration for the web container attributes. So and you can see that we have the reload enable, file serving enable, directory browsing enable. So those attributes are defined in this IBM Web Extension XML file. Okay, slide 20, please. Okay, so now let's look at the web container custom properties. So we only have some of the most popular, custom properties that we see a lot and have been using a lot. So unlike the web container attribute, you can configure the custom property at the admin console, and these properties will be used by all the application deployed in that server. So if your application wants to override some of the web container custom property, you can do that by configuring a similar web container attribute in the IBM Web Extension XML file. And the setting in the IBM Web Extension XML file takes precedence over the global settings that are set through the custom property at the web container level. So the first custom property that we look at is the COM IBM WS web container. This allows all file serving. By default, it's set to false, but when you set it to true, it just allows the application server to serve the static file. So this affects all the application deployed in the server. So all the applications cannot serve the static file. And if you want specific applications to serve the static file, you can make that change by, configure the file serving enable in the IBM Web Extension XML file. The next custom property is COM IBM WS Web Container. This allows serve servlet by class name. By default, it's also set to false. So when you set it to true, it's just allowed to access the server in all applications by its class name. And another one is COM IBM WS Web Container Do Not Serve by Class Name. If you don't want some specific server to be served by its class name, then use this property to specify a list of those classes. Slide 21, please. The two property on this slide is COM IBM WS Web Container Extract Host Header Port and Trust Host Header Port. these two custom properties are configured together. So when they set it to true, the application will use the port from the host header instead of from, you know, the port from the request URL. We usually use these two custom properties for redirect issue, where you see that the port number is from the redirect URL is incorrect. For example, if the request is going to the load balancer and then to the app server, and then app server does send redirect, but the redirect URL contains incorrect port number, when you see this problem, you can configure these two custom properties, and that should help to, you know, correct the issue. Slide 22, please. Can you go to slide 22, please? COM IBM WS Web Container Channel Write Type. The web container uses asynchronous writes to write the response data in chunks up to the response by buffer. So the response by buffer by default is set to 32 kilobytes. So if the response is more than the response buffer size, the web container continues to buffer the response into the memory while waiting for a write of the response data chunk up to complete. So this process can lead to a high memory usage or possibly an out of memory. So if you want to prevent an out of memory issue, you can set this property to sync. So that synchronous writing is used and response data are written synchronously. And this way, no response data are buffered into memory. So we're usually using this, you know, for the out of memory issue. So slide 23, please. COM IBM WS Web Container Skip Meta NF Resource Processing. So starting in WebSphere version 8.0, we support Server 3.0. And searching for the static resource in the draw file is required by Server 3.0. So the web container search for the static files and JSP file in four different locations, such as the application world directory, the web client app directory, the meta inf resource directory, and extended document root directory. So if you have a large EF file, the search can cause a performance impact. So if the application is not relying on the Server 3.0 searching behavior, you can disable resource searching by setting this custom property to true, which should help to improve performance. Slide 24, please. So this is the last popular web container custom property is COM IBM WS Web Container XP-only cookies. So the XP-only on setting on the JSON ID cookie is a new function that we add in FixPath 709 and 61031. So you use this property when you want to add the XP-only to the cookies. The purpose of the XP only is enable protection from the client-side script access. So in WebSphere version 8.0 and higher, the XP only is added to the JSON ID cookie by default. So if you want to disable the XP only from the JSON ID cookie, then you can go to the admin console under the session management cookie and then uncheck the checkbox set. Session cookies to HP only to help prevent cross-site scripting attacks. So in WebSphere 8.0, you only use this custom property to add HP only to the application cookie, but not to the JSON ID. So that's different with the version 7.0 and 6.1, where you can use this property to add the HP only to the JSON ID. Okay, slide 25, please. So this slide, I provide an example how to add the HP only to the application cookies. So it could be a very similar way if you want to add, you know, configure any other web container custom property. You will go to the same panel and then specify the name of the web container custom property and then its value. Okay, slide 26, please. So after you configure the web container custom property, you will get back to this panel, and this is what it looks like. And you can also find the same information about the web container custom property that you have configured for the server by looking at the server XML file, in which I have shown, you know, an example at the bottom of this slide. Okay, slide 27, please. So we just so now we're gonna go into the virtual host configuration. What is it, and then how you can map the virtual host to the application. So by default, the app server provides a virtual host called default host with some common aliases. Such as IP address, DNS short hostname, and DNS fully qualified hostname. So a DNS alias consists of the hostname and the port number. For example, like myhost :9080, where you can use this in the request URL. Please note that the host alias must be unique in all virtual hosts configured in the shell. So if you have a duplicate host alias, your request might be sent to the wrong server, and you will get an error like the virtual host or web application not found. You can associate a virtual host to one or more web modules, but you cannot associate each web module to more than one virtual host. So make a note of that. So, you know, a lot of time we see an issue with, you know, when you get an error of virtual host or web application not found. Usually it's more with the virtual host configuration. You know, you might have a duplicate host alias in the virtual host configuration. Okay, slide 28, please. So here's an example of the virtual host default host, which you can find under in the admin console under environment virtual host. And the picture on the right hand side shows all the host alias that define for the default host. Slide 29, please. So you can find the same information for the virtual host configuration in the virtual host XML file. I provide, you know, the path where you can find the virtual host XML file, and this is what it looks like. So it's very similar to what you see from the admin console. It contains the similar information. Slide 30, please. So once you have the virtual host defined, then you can map the virtual host to the web modules for your application. In this example, you know, we have the web app 25 that is mapped to the virtual host default host. Like I mentioned before, you can associate the web module to only one virtual host, and it can be done from this panel. Slide 31, please. In this slide, I provide information where you can find what port number your application server is listening on. There are two ways to do that. First is go into the admin console and look under application server, server name, and then port. In this example, the app server is listening on the port 9080 as the non-secure port, and port 9443 as a secure port. Another is to review the server index XML file where you can find a similar information, and I will provide a screenshot at the bottom of this slide. Okay, slide 32, please. So now the last part of this presentation is we look at the Java EE application structure and what are the XML file, what to look for in the XML file. So what constructs up the Java EE application? The Java EE application are applications that conform to a Java 2 platform, Enterprise Edition, and specification. So it is packaged in an EE file, and an EE file may contain one or more web modules, the EJB's modules, resource adapter, and the Java EE application client. The web module packaged into a WAR file, and EJBs are packaged into a JAR, and both WAR and EJBs are packaged in the EE file. The utilities JARs or the third-party JAR file can be packaged at the root of the EE file, and they are visible to all the web all the modules in the EE. Which means all the modules in the EE can share the utility JAR file at the EE level. Okay, slide 33, please. So this is how the Java EE application structure look like. So inside the EE file, you can find one or more web modules, EJB modules, application client modules, and resource adapter modules. The deployment XML file is not part of the Java EE application. This file is provided by Webview application server that contains configuration data on the application deployment, such as the application class setting for the application and the shared library association or the target server that the application is mapped to. So you can find this information in the deployment XML file. The application XML and the web XML file are part of the Java EE application. The IBM Web Extension XML and IBM Web BY XML files are provided by IBM to support additional options beyond the Java 2 EE specification. So you can find these two XML files along with the web XML file at the root, inside the web module under the Web BINF lib directory. We will look at these XML files in detail in the later slide. Slide 34, please. So by default, when you install the application, it will extract your application to the profile root install app directory. And that directory contains your server, JSP, and XML file. But during the runtime, the server will read the XML file in the profile config directory, but not from the install app directory. So if you require to modify an XML file after your application is installed, you will need to modify them under the config directory and not in the install app directory. If you want the application server to use the XML file in the install app directory, you still can do that by enable the option Use Configuration Information in Binary, and which I will show you how to do that in the next slide. So slide 35, please. Here's how you enable the server to use the XML file in the install app directory and set up the config directory. So just check the checkbox Use Configuration Information in Binary. And when you make that change, you still have to restart the server, so it will pick up this change. Slide 36, please. There are two application XML files that can be viewed from the FN console, and they are application XML file and web XML file. In this table, I provide the information where you can navigate to the application XML and web XML file from the FN console. Okay, slide 37, please. So now let's look at each application XML file in detail. The first one that we're going to look at is the deployment XML file. As I mentioned before, each web module must be mapped to one or more server. So to find out what server that your web module is mapped to, then you can review the deployment XML file, or you can navigate to the that panel at the bottom of this slide. Well, so in this example, the web app 25 is mapped to the web server 1 and the app server 1. So that means when you access this application, you can access it directly to the app server through the server 1, or you can access it to the web server and then to the app server. Slide 38, please. The next XML file is the application XML file. The application XML file is a part of the J2E specification. So you can find the context root information for your web application in the web application XML file. So in this example, it shows there's only one web module, web app 25, and its context root is / web app 25. If you have more than one web module, you will see all the web module listed in this application XML file with their context root detail. Slide 39, please. The web XML is also part of the J2E application. It defines everything about your application that the server needs to know, such as like servlet mapping, filter mapping, listener, initialization parameters, container manage, security constraint, resource, welcome page, or an error page. You can view the web XML file also from the Appen console. So in this slide, I show that where you can navigate to it. So slide 40, please. In this web XML file, first you will find the filter configuration. You can map a filter to a servlet or to a URL pattern. In this case, the filter WCSR201 is mapped to all servlets, so that's why you can see the servlet name with an asterisk there. So when you access any within this application, it will go through this filter. Dispatcher forward include error and request. This means that the filter should be applied to requests directly from the client as well as a forward request. It should also be applied for include request and the error page request. So right below there is an example of defining servlet mapping for WCSR202. So we will see the mapping in the next slide. Slide 41, please. So in the older version of the server spec, it allows only a single URL pattern or the server name per server mapping. But in the server spec 2.5 and up, you can provide as many server mapping you want in a single mapping block. So in this case, there's a 4-year pattern for the server WCSR002, which means you can access the server WCSR002 by using one of the 4-year pattern defined here. We also have the welcome file defined in here. The welcome file is an index HTML file. So serving a welcome file is connected to serving a static content. So if you want to have the welcome file to be served, you must enable file serving enable in order to serve the server to the welcome file. So this also applies to the JSP file if you define a JSP file as a welcome file. This web XML file also has an error page defined for a 404 error. Please note that, you know, to serve an AeroPage, the application must be up and running. So if your application is down, we don't have any other configuration available to configure a custom AeroPage. So in order to invoke the AeroPage, your application must be up to serve it. Slide 42, please. This is an example of the WebXML file where you can define the security constraints. The user will require to authenticate in order to access the resource with the URL pattern defined here. So in this example, all authenticate user can access the URL path / WCSR003. Okay, so the next slide, 43, please. In this example, the security constraint tells the server to use the form login to authenticate the user when they access the protected resource. So this is where you define, you know, what type of authentication method that you want to use, either like the basic, the form, or the there's also the client authentication. So in this example, it showed, you know, it's using the form login if you want to access any protected resource. Slide 44, please. So IBM Web Extension by XML file. This XML file is provided by IBM, and this file shows what virtual host the application is mapped to. Remember that your application can be mapped to only one virtual host, and you can find that information in this XML file. Slide 45, please. I think this is the last XML file. So it's the IBM Web Extension XML file. So this file is where we're using to configure all the web container attributes and also the JSP attributes. Again, if you want to change the value for any attribute defined in this file, you will have to manually edit this file under the config folder. We don't have the GUI interface from the admin console to modify this file, so you have to manually modify it if you want to make any change to this file. Slide 46, please. So that brings us to the end of this presentation. So what we have done is we went over an overview of the server specification. Then we looked at the web container setting from the admin console. We discussed the most popular web container attributes and custom properties, what they are using for and how to configure them. And then we also look at the virtual host configuration and how to map the web application to a virtual host. And last, we went over the Java EE application and its configuration XML file, where you can locate the application XML file and what to look for in the XML file. So slide 47, please. So here are some of the present links that we add here. You can get more detail for some of the topics we went through in this presentation from these links. And slide 48. So now I think I would like to pass the controller back to Kathy.
Thank you, Gabrielle and Tom, for a great presentation. At this time, we would like to open the lines for questions.
Our question comes from Steve. Your line is open, sir.
Yes. Thank you for the presentation. Very good. Good job. I had a question regarding the file serving enabled. You talked about the file serving enabled property within the application IBM Web EXT file. But then you also talked about the custom property, web container disallow all file serving. if those are set to opposite values, like maybe disallow all file serving is true, but also file serving enabled in the application is true, which one of those overrides the other one? In other words, which one would take precedence if they're configured oppositely?
Hi, Steve. This is Pan. So the configuration that defined in the IBM Web EXT XML file will take precedence over the custom property defined at the web container level.
Okay. So you were saying that that property, the file serving enabled property, is true by default, right?
Yes.
So if I want to set web container disallow all file serving to true, do I have to also go to each application and change the file serving to false?
So if you want, you know, any specific application, you know, that not to serve the static file, then you have to modify that IBM Web Extension XML file to change the file serving enabled to false. So otherwise, we're using the disallow all file serving configuration from the admin console.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Steve, this is Ashish. Just wanted to add a little detail about why these two layers exist. So, for example, in the customer environment, there are 100 applications, and only few need to have that switch. So, this global parameter at application server, you can set which eventually, you know, can change the things across the board, and then you can just switch it back at the application level, which you really don't want and want the file serving enabled. And all these properties is really being used by the plugin generation component, which eventually, you know, generates the plugin files such a way that, you know, the plugin will make decisions of sending forwarding the request to application servers for the static versus dynamic.
We do have a question in the web conference. How will the web container allocate threads within same session? If user refresh pages 10 times, will all requests be served by the same web container thread, or will it open 10 different web container threads?
Thank you. So this question is more towards properties of HTTP transport properties. So and that properties, you can go to the application server, web container, the channel framework, or web container transport chain. And then when you click on one of the particular ports that it's listening on the web containers, generally by default it's 9080 web inbound default, now you have three layers, TCP channel properties, HTTP channel properties, and web container channel properties. And if you click on HTTP channel properties, the particular settings that really get engaged in your question is the keep alive, or the persistence. By default, the persistence is turned on. What that means is when the browser sends first request to the application server, it gets handled by, let's say, web container thread 1. And after sending a response back, we don't close that connection. We persist for 30 seconds by default. And within the 30 seconds, if the same browser sends another request, it will be handled by the same same web container thread, and it will continue going to you know, until the persistence lasts. If you change that persistence value to zero, that means we are not going to persist. And after each request, the response is served, the connection will be closed. So, Ramesh Kumar, did this answer your question?
He replied, yes, it did. So that's good. I don't see anything else in the web conference. Okay. So at this time, we will conclude the presentation. Thank you again for joining us, and thank you, Ashish, Fu, Gabrielle, and Tan, for presenting today. Everyone have a great day.